You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC, located on the unceded traditional Coast Salish territory of the Musqueam people. Hello, and welcome to Intersections, presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. This radio show is presented every 4 weeks, where we dig into topics about gender, race, and social justice. We open our show with a conversation between your hosts, followed by an interview with an expert on the topic that we will be discussing.
Hello, and welcome to Intersections. My name is Anastasia.
My name is Chimki.
My name is Randy.
And we're going to talk about toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
And I would like to just start it all off by asking how each of us would define toxic masculinity and our experiences with it so far. So maybe I'll just say mine, and then we'll go around the circle. I would define toxic masculinity as like unspoken rules of I guess the typical gender norms, and also just kind of like I feel like toxic masculinity, you can tell from the title, masculinity that's toxic, but also I do think there's like a emphasis on the fact that if the idea is that you should never really talk about it, like if you're gonna uphold toxic masculinity, then like everything, you shouldn't question how men act towards women and historically, like it's like a conservative way of thinking about gender and to stick to that like rigidly. And with my experiences with it so far, I feel like, I mean, everyone has it. I mean, it's like, you know, like, it's almost kind of funny, like, experiences, it's like our lives.
Yeah.
It's like, it's in me. it's even though I try to be more aware of it if I ever do think about it. Like, honestly, if I do see, like, maybe a man wearing berets, a part of me goes, what? And then I go, like, no, that's lit. Like, it'll be,
yeah.
It gets shorter and shorter the time I go, like, huh? But, like, it's still there, and I kind of hate that, but then I have to recognize that's how it is. But I guess with experiences where it's hurt me the most is kind of friendships. For me, and maybe that's lucky, I feel like it sucks when your boyfriends are like that, or, you know. But, yeah, for friendships I've had, like, yeah, where they just, you know, they treat me like I can't handle them. I'm a girl, like that would happen in high school. Like, you know.
Yeah, definitely in high school there were moments where we'd be like, this is how we feel and this is why we're afraid of the things that we're afraid of, and then they'd be like, that's a ridiculous way to be, and I was like, okay, lovely to be friends with you guys, really great time. So yeah, I definitely felt that as well. I don't know exactly how I define it. I think it's just, yeah, it's like that rigidity, like you're supposed to be this way, and if you're another way, then it's wrong. So like really lean heavily into this, right? Like being, you know, getting women, being macho, like wearing traditional like men's clothing, I'm doing air quotes. Yeah, like that's what I think. I think everyone can practice toxic masculinity. I think everyone kind of does a little bit. And just like some people are just more aware, like trying to be aware of trying to stop that. But yeah, I think it's definitely something that we're all taught as we're like growing up, and we see it and we believe it. It's all, yeah, that's my piece.
Yeah, I think it's totally, it's just like a subscription to like heteronormative gender norms. Like it's just, it's this idea that there are men and women and they behave in certain ways, and anything outside of those distinct behaviors is inappropriate and it's not allowed. So like examples of like, you know, if a man wears a dress, they are no longer a man. Like I think it's that like toxicity, exactly what you said, Anastasia, like it's in the title. It's not that masculinity is inherently toxic. It's that there's areas of it that are toxic. And those are the parts that like, and it's a lot, like it's the violence. It's, you know, like even just like the way, like, yeah, just like men are taught, like, you know, like the slogans, boys will be boys, locker room talk, you know, like we've all heard those. And that to me is like the embodiment of like how we see toxic masculinity in our society. Mm-hmm. And yeah, also, yeah, everyone experiences it. Like I, same thing, like I grew up in a small town. So like very strict on the gender roles. And so like in my head, I would do exactly the same thing. Like if a guy ever did something outside of what I felt a guy should do, it was the rejection of like, you're not a man, you know, like yeah. You're weak, you're effeminate. And like trying to break those ideas that we have in our mind is like how we kind of counter to have positive masculinity. Cause it's totally positive. Yeah. It's just like, we have positive femininity and there's also toxic femininity. So mm-hmm. like things can be good and bad parts of it.
Yeah, definitely. And like, yeah, it's like, so it's so fragile. Like if you step out of that like idea of masculinity, like this like traditional one, then like you're not a man anymore. Like that's such a awful way to live, right? Like that your identity is so like could be taken from you at any time. Yeah, I definitely don't see that with like a lot of other with a lot of other identities. Yeah, I think that I definitely, as a young girl, I did really think that like in elementary school, I didn't think that guys had feelings, you know, I thought that I could say whatever to them and like insult them and then be like, ha ha, you know, like, just take it. Right.
Yeah.
I didn't think they were supposed to be able to like, I didn't think that they, yeah, would react or like that it would really hurt them. And as I like started to have like guy friends later on, I was like, it finally clicked for me. But that was something that I had to realize. And that's how I know like how toxic it is, right? And like, and how I know that I was like perpetuating it as well with the guys that I was speaking to. But yeah. Now that I have realized this, I have tried to be more aware of like, kind of like the language that I use with guys. Yeah, like I'm not gonna be like sack up, get over it, but like I'm not gonna do that.
I also feel like, oh, like another side of it is like the complete rejection of like anything feminine. So like you know, like sports teams, like you play ball like a girl, you throw like a girl,
right?
Don't cry, you're not a girl, like just that, like it's like this like constant need to like have it separated, whereas I think like having like secure masculinity is like, you know, it's fluid, like it's able to move, it's able to adapt things that are positive because communication is healthy, like feelings are good, emotions are real. So yeah, I feel like getting away from that like rejection of like things that are outside of this binary, I think it's just important.
Yeah, I think I think that's exactly what I was feeling, where I was like, feelings are for me, I'm a girl, you can't have none. Like I really feel like that's how I was acting as a child.
I acted that way till high school, I'm gonna be honest. I was just super crass. I like, and then with my female friends, it was almost like sometimes the complete opposite. I'm like, oh, I'll nurture you. Like girls don't need to be girl tough too.
Yeah.
And also when you, Randy, what you said about rejection of femininity, it made me think exactly of, that's what like gay men are often judged for. If they like, any way that they act feminine, any way that they act, it's actually like high voice, like being more emotionally expressive, like wearing like more, like it's all linked to femininity. And it's like, and it's just super like, yeah, it's because toxic masculinity is also a rejection of things that are feminine. And it's that, it's definitely the binary, but I think it's interesting when it comes to like sexuality, it's that, and it like, and then gay men, unfortunately, like I've seen it, and like, just from like where I've seen gay men speak out about this, it's that there's a lot of hate in their communities as well. Like, I don't know, this drag queen said that gay people are sometimes the most homophobic. And although I don't know if that's true, I can see how it can feel that way, because like mask for mask is on gay dating sites. Like they're telling you, like, don't, I'm not attracted to you if you act feminine. Like,
yeah.
Like it's that, it's, and it's just super sad, honestly. Like I've heard my friends be like, oh, I don't want to act too gay. It's like, because they're probably, they're like, if you're gay, you're probably already judged in childhood.
Yeah.
Hopefully now people are more open to that. I think it's a little bit better, but like, and then like you take it into your life and you choose your partners based on this like idea of what you should and should not be. Even mm-hmm. though, to be honest, you're already being hated on by hetero, like, by yeah. hetero people if they have the same toxic masculinity. So it's yeah.
Yeah.
It leaks everywhere.
Definitely. Like, I think, like, when you're taught to hate anything that's different about yourself, like, you internalize it. Like, same thing for, like, internalized homophobia, racism, right? Like, all of those things. And that's, and internalized homophobia, I feel like, yeah, it's definitely a big part of, like, toxic masculinity, because you're not allowed to be fluid or like experiment or like explore your sexuality, because like you know, like toxic men don't do that. So like, yeah, so definitely I see how you would take that in with yourself.
Yeah. And I think also, like, speaking about what you said, like Anastasia, I read Liz Plank has a book called For the Love of Men, and it's about toxic masculinity. And throughout a lot of the book, it's based around interviews she does with men. And so one of the interviews she did, she interviewed a gay football player. I can't remember if he's retired or if he's currently playing, but he was one of the first openly gay football players. And mm-hmm. I'm sure you can imagine what it's like to be gay in the NFL. Yeah. And he said, like, he understands homophobia as misogyny, mm-hmm. because it's kind of this, like, because if you think about it, like, we put women in this role as like pleasing men, and as a gay man you now fall into that quote unquote feminine role. And so like I thought it was just a really interesting point. Obviously there's a lot of nuance and context to that, but I think thinking through that and understanding that like misogyny is a huge part of toxic masculinity. Yeah. And it directly relates to that, like exactly what you were saying, Anastasia.
It's so fragile, it's so insecure, it's all these, like, it's a lot of just, like, lashing out, you know, because you're not allowed to try to understand yourself for who you are, so you're always lashing out at other people, like, and yourself, sure, but, like, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's a good point, I think, that, like, you can't understand yourself, like, that's definitely part of toxic masculinity, like you've got it already figured out, like you're bringing home the bread, you're working, like you don't have time for therapy or like or reviewing your actions or like. And also it makes women feel bad, like I feel like I have felt bad if I like, to be honest, I feel like I could never tell my dad like, oh, something you do is kind of toxic, because it's like I would expect he would instantly reject that with, I don't have time for this, you know. And a part of me would understand, but that's because the role's already there. It's already done. Like he does provide. And I understand, but I just, yeah, it's definitely like, yeah, it's hard to bring up to men too. Like I don't know. Maybe I'm skipping a little ahead, but kind of with friendships, like, mm-hmm. You know, like I told my friend that I didn't really like, when I was thinking of going over to his house, he asked me about four different times in the same hangout, like, yeah. Do you feel okay with that? Do you feel safe? Which I totally respected, but I told him after the first time that was kind of weird for him to keep on asking me. Yeah. And then I started to get paranoid, because I'm honestly paranoid about my male friends possibly harassing me. Like, mm-hmm. I hate that, but it's like, it's a real fear. Like, women are usually assaulted by people they know compared to men, like, yeah. That's the statistic, so I guess it's not crazy I think that way. But yeah. He was just completely silent when I told him how I was feeling, like he just didn't know how to respond. Like, men just like literally are starting from like baby steps with all of this.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, it's like, it's like the difference, like women like usually like with my friendships we talk about our feelings like all the time. And sometimes it can be rumination, and you talk about the same thing too much.
Right.
And but then like men don't talk about it at all. And like, I don't know how to you know.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like maybe some guys do talk about it, but I do get where you're coming from, where it's like sometimes it feels like you're introducing this like whole new skill set to them and they have so much resistance to it because they're like, I've never done this and I've never needed to do this and I'm fine so far. And like that's the attitude that you get, and it's so frustrating because you're like, I'm ultimately like trying to help you and like trying to help our relationship, so I don't really be wanting this flack when I try to do this. Yeah.
I think my dad is, he's lucky because I am a GRS change major, so you bet that he gets the rundown on everything. And yeah, he has lived in Southern Alberta his whole life, farmer. And it's interesting. It is really interesting. I bought him, so I gave him Liz Plank's book. He hasn't started reading it yet, but I'm working on it. But I also, for one of my classes, we read this really good short graphic novel about they, them pronouns, non-binary identities. Mm. And it was a really good introduction. Like it had really good information. It was stuff that I previously learned, but I was like, wow, this is really good. I'm going to give it to my dad. Yeah. And it was just like, it was very interesting giving him the book and him being like, oh, like, what is this? And like, it was interesting because I knew that like, he had no exposure to this, like the concept of non-binary gender identity and like thinking outside of the binary basically. And so it was really cool to like, see his reaction. And like, you could tell his like brain was like, okay, what, like, and you could tell like kind of like the steps he was going through to like think about it. And I admit, like, learning all of these new things, it can feel overwhelming. Yeah. But I think like, yeah, the point is like being open and like creating spaces where like we can talk about toxic masculinity with men, and it can be like a space where everyone is learning, like people are sharing their experiences, both men and women, because again, it hurts everyone. Like it's a system that hurts everyone under it. Thank you, patriarchy. And so, yeah, so I think just like, that's one thing I really appreciate. Like when I do bring this stuff to my dad, it sometimes comes off, but then I know that like pretty quickly he'll come to me and be like, okay, let's talk about this. And yeah, I hope that like more people start doing that essentially.
Yeah, it's not about like getting everything from the beginning, from the get-go. You just have to like, you know, be, you know, just like, yeah, like what you're saying, like just be open to, yeah, the idea that there is something, yeah, different, and that it is just as like valid as any other experience, right?
Yeah,
I definitely think it takes like, definitely like, yeah, like I was just thinking like Chimgi when you said like, like some men are open to talking about emotions, and that's definitely true. And I think what you can sense with like the men that just do feel like, I feel like the moment you meet a man, sometimes you can just tell. And I feel like, and I think it's kind of the fact that they probably worked on themselves, like mentally checked in, like you can usually, and I feel like that's what's kind of what's sad is like, and I see with like men in my life is sometimes they wouldn't want to, you know, they're not perpetrating it, but it's kind of like when you've decided that you hate yourself for something, it's super hard. You can't almost really hear it from anybody else or won't hit the, yeah, same way. And so like, it's important that they don't push this onto other people. I think that takes something else in you. And there might be experiences in your life, or maybe you're just like an aggressive person. You should work on that. Like that shouldn't be it. Like, and I think people accept aggression from men so easily. But yeah. I think definitely men should just, I don't know, like get therapy. I just think therapy is very, like, I know it's expensive, but I definitely just see that there's a lot that men have to do to kind of realize that they don't need to hate themselves for these very fragile things, because, you know, like that's I think what a lot of women have compassion for, because we're kind of on the outside being like, when they're not being like perpetrating it, is that they're just hating themselves for these small things. They're just like restricting themselves in these ways that we're like, we don't want you to do that. Like, yeah, we don't, you know. And it takes like a lot of work to not to kind of, you know, like, it's, yeah, it always takes a lot of work to, like, release yourself from these judgments you've had about yourself since you were young and these things you've been taught that you should be doing. Yeah, I just think, I hope men, if they would hear, you know, if they're listening, you
know, at least, like, start reading about it, you know what I mean? See if anything resonates. Like, I think that's, even if you can't go to a therapist, like, there's, you can still find ways to, like, learn more about this and, like, yeah, see if there's small things you can change. I don't know, like, I think it's, like, it's so hard because, like, yeah, if you've been telling yourself something for, like, most of your life, that's going to be so hard to change, or, like, even start to change or just confront, right? But, like, you have to do it for your own good, for everyone's good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Both.
Yeah. And I feel like that's exactly, like, our guest, Dr. Frank, when he brought up, like, the role that feminism has played in, like, the fight against toxic masculinity and, like, exploring these ideas. I think that's definitely, like, something that we all need to realize that, like, yeah, like, it's hard for men, yes, to, like, get involved and, like, understand these, but it also is their job. Like, they, you know, they gotta get in there and they gotta talk through it and they gotta fix it up, because, like, at the end of the day, they are the ones that are, like, in these experiences. Like, they are the ones who are, like, in toxic masculinity, perpetuating it, holding it up. And, like, yes, women totally do those things too, but, like, I think it's kind of, like, where the change comes from, like, inside. You know, it's the same with, like, feminism. Like, we all owe it to be intersectional and accepting and fight for everyone's rights. And, like, I don't know, one time when I was driving home with my dad and I asked him, I said, are you a feminist? And he says, well, I believe in equality. And I says, are you a feminist? He goes, well, can be feminist. And when he asked me that, that's when I, like, kicked in. I was like, wait, like, do men not think that they can, like, do, because that's valid. Like, maybe no one has told these men, yeah, you can be involved, you can be a feminist, because you deserve these, like, you deserve to be free too. You deserve to be free of toxic masculinity. You deserve to, like, have your own identity and, like, express your gender however you want. And that's part of what a lot of feminism is fighting for. Yeah. And yeah, I think just, like, not having it as, like, the burden of women, non-binary people, trans people to fight for these rights, and having cis men also being involved.
Yeah.
Is, like, really what we need to move forward.
Yeah, it's key. They got, they have so much power. Come on. I mean, like, maybe that doesn't apply in this case when they're, like, talking about something that's very, like, personal to them. Maybe they don't feel very powerful doing it against everything that they've, I don't know, thought about, whatever. But yeah, like, they have to be a part of it. They need to be leading this change. It's for them. Like, I mean, it feels so good not to hate yourself. Or to, like, allow yourself and to be different, right? Like, that's something that I think everyone should be able to feel.
And they are supporting, like, because men, like, gender, like, I think it's, well, in psychology, like, we're, like, at a young age, you do usually hang out with people of your own gender. Mm-hmm. And it can mix later in life, but that is kind of, like, it's part of it is a natural thing. And if, like, there are abusers who are getting away with it and are being supported by their friends, and then they believe that it's okay. And I remember talking to my friend about this, and he's like, I'm not a confrontational person, so I probably wouldn't bring up if my friend was doing something like that. And it broke my heart, because, like, it's the bystander. You can't, if an abuser, once they get to a point, like, they're not going to change. And you know, it's not, you can't be victim blaming, and you can't unfortunately change the person doing it. It is the bystander. And, like, men, I think men should definitely take more responsibility for the fact that they're in those friend groups. Like, you can't be victim blaming women and men who are the victims of male abuse from men, because the majority of men.
If you see it and you know that you have an inkling that it's happening, then now you're a part of it, right? And you need to do something about it. It's like, that's just the way it is, and you can't act like you're exempt from this, you know, like, I feel lot of men are like, I'm not a part of this, and, like, that's so great that you have the privilege to be able to say that, but that's just not true, you know?
Yeah. It's, like, with every, social justice issue, we all need to call out injustice, and we all know it when we see it. We're taught from a young age what it looks like. Some of it we learn later on in life, but unless all of us are calling it out, real change just can't happen. I think that this conversation, obviously, like, I don't know about you, but I could talk about this for a very long time. This is, like, one of my passions in my program. And yeah, but I think this conversation has been really good. We talked about a lot of points. Thank you for joining us, listeners.
Thank you.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
Accessibility,
disability,
mental health,
ADHD and ADD,
and many, many more topics we explore and cover.
But where?
On CITR's All Access Pass.
A unique and collectively run show on equity, inclusion, and creating awareness for people of all abilities in BC and around the world.
Catch us every other Wednesday afternoon from 3 to 4.
If you want more info or want to get involved, please find us on Facebook or send us an email at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
Hello and welcome back to Intersections. We are here with our guest, Dr. Bly Frank, who is the Dean of the Faculty of Education at the University of British Columbia. His research interests include masculinity and sociology of boys and men's health. Dr. Frank is a scholar and an activist with many years of experience in the field. Thank you, Dr. Frank, for being here.
You're most welcome. Happy to be here.
We'll start off with our first question. So the first thing we want to discuss is toxic masculinity. So we want to ask you to talk a little bit about and define toxic masculinity, as well as share, if you're comfortable, a little bit about your personal experience with toxic masculinity.
Well, let me take you back a few years when I was actually doing my PhD in the sociology of masculinity. And I was interviewing young men between the age of 16 and 20 at the time. And I was not asking them about masculinity. I thought that might cause a bit of concern. So I was trying to get it at the issue of masculinity through other questions. So one of the questions I asked those young men was, what does it mean to be a young man your age? So I asked the young man whom I was interviewing, what does it mean to be a young man your age? And one young man immediately said, well, sports, looks, and a woman, that's what every guy needs to be successful as a young man. And so what I did in a second round of interviews was frame some questions around that. And of course, so I don't want to be negatively speaking of sports or body image or, in this case, a woman, heterosexuality. But it was interesting to begin to do an analysis around this. And of course, what you see is then at least, and I think it's changed a bit, but perhaps not a lot, what a strong weave of violence for young men in particular in sports, in body image, because they were doing many things to create a certain body, that is all the way from certain uses of certain drugs to enhance the body, to spending a lot of time working out, in some ways doing activities which as an older man will result in injury. So violence to the body. And then we all know by now the violence that's located in some And I put that with emphasis in some heterosexual relations. So sports, looks, and a woman. So I raise that because if we begin to look at toxic masculinity, I think what we know is a wide range of violence at many levels. So let me say one more thing to lead us further into this discussion. What I'm interested in is what I call a sociology of practice. That is what men and boys, what all of us, but what men and boys in this case, what they actually do. So that I say masculinity is actually a social accomplishment. You do it as young men and as boys and so on. So it's accomplished. It's Judith Butler and other work, it's a performance, right? It is in fact what you do with your body. So when you think of sports, looks, and a woman, the violent weave through there, the harm to oneself and often to others, seems to me begins to package toxic masculinity in a certain kind of way. So what I would talk about in relation to toxic masculinity, it's not only toxic to other people, which it certainly is, but it's also toxic to one's own body in many ways. In other words, toxic masculinity is very harmful in both the relations you have, and let's be clear here, it's not the relations with not only other people and oneself, but it's not boys and young men in their relations with girls and women only. And I know that I'm using a very by analysis in talking about men and women. And I know now that even that is much more complicated. We'll park that for the moment. But my point is here, it's not boys and young men in the relationships just with girls and women. It is also their relationships with other men. So if you think all the way from the sports activity to territorial wars, that has generally been men and men. So there is a lot of violence in toxic masculinity toward members of the same sex. I'll pause.
I like how, you put it that it's violence to themselves and to others. I think, violence is really key to that. And we're wondering what are some key issues, like parts of our society that you believe that toxic masculinity has played a large role in creating or upholding?
Well, it operates at the macro level. So by that I mean the institutions in which we exist. So I use this kind of silly example, but and there again, I want to say that I am in no way being derogatory about all sports. I mean, sport activity is very good if it's accomplished in the right set of relations. But I would say, for example, if we look, and many people have looked at issues like minor hockey, boys minor hockey in particular. And what we have are lots of cited incidents of really strong violence on the ice, young men to young men, boy to boy, and adult men to adult men. We also have, historically, I think they've tried to stop this in some cases by actually barring parents and guardians from the ice rink, because it's been noted that some people would say, kill them, get them. So the encouragement. So is parenting involved in this? And I don't want to say all parents, and I don't want to blame parents, but is there an issue of parenting here where people need to be very much educated about these issues? If we take the issue of schools and schooling and education, we know that there has been violence and toxic masculinity available in schools. So, at one point I did some ethnographic studies in gymnasiums and listened to coaches and what they were saying, and the sexism and the homophobia, you know, saying to a high school basketball team, what's wrong with you? You're playing like a bunch of girls today. I mean, the sexism historically, and I think still, can be very prevalent in institutions. So that's at a macro level, and then at a much more micro level in the relationships between and among people. So whether it's the simple, and it's not simple at all, but the issue of bullying, and I'm not suggesting that girls don't bully. I know that, you know, regardless, people are of sex and gender, people are involved in bullying. But if you look at the bullying, in this case, a piece of toxic masculinity that goes on, and it goes on among and between adult men as well. So at that more micro relationship level, and, you know, I think we want to say that there's nothing natural about this. I mean, there's a whole body of literature wants to argue, you know, and then people use it in the everyday discourse of saying, oh, well, boys will be boys, you know, as if it's a kind of natural located in our DNA. Well, you know, I've never fallen there because, you know, I, as naive as it may be, always want to live with a politic of hope. And that means why I'm so hooked on that these are pieces of practice, because if it's practice, we can change practice. Mm-hmm. And so it's located at a macro level. It's located in the more micro level and in every space in between. And we often not only support it, but if you're a spectator in many sports arenas, or even if two men get in a fight on the street, not only do we support it, we actually celebrate it. I say, you know, if what happened over the tomatoes in the grocery store while we were shopping, if what happened in the ice rink happened in the grocery store, somebody would be in a lot of trouble. Yet in the ice rink, and it feels like I'm picking on hockey, and I don't mean to, but in the ice rink, we not only accept it, we often celebrate it. So the celebration of violence is within toxic masculinity is also a key issue here. Sorry, that was a long answer.
No, it was a good one. We were, when we were thinking of these questions, we also wondered what you would think about what upholds rape culture. Maybe what institutions you might have noticed where this thrives the most, and maybe your research.
Well, I think there again, the way young men learn their masculinity and also learn their sexuality, I mean, learned in a, for some young men, this is not all young men there again, but for some young men, learned within a discourse of conquest, learned within a discourse of power, learned within a discourse of expectations around that conquest and how you should operate and what you should do. If we turn that on its head, there's very little expectation that women would operate this way. I mean, that's not to say that they may not do some of this in other ways, but this notion of conquest, this notion of getting her, I mean, even the notion of getting a date, I mean, it just, if you listen to the everyday language, and, you know, I would say that, you know, we don't, for most of us who are speaking individuals, at least, we don't operate outside the discourse, which we learn to write and speak ourselves into existence. Now, that's a bit theoretical, but, you know, the way we exist is through the discourse that we speak ourselves and others into existence. So if you learn a discourse of conquest or a discourse of takeover, then it seems to me if you push and within a discourse of power and a practice of power, if you absolutely push this to somewhere over here on the continuum, you know, you get rape. And, you know, I mean, it's the age old thing. And I hope a lot of this has now stopped, but I worry, you know, it's the age old thing about, you know, you may at your age not have heard the expressions about notching the belt. That is how many conquests you've actually had along the way. I mean, one of the interesting things there again is to upsetting, but interesting, is listen to some boys having conversations in relation to dating young women and so on, and how they frame that. Now, you know, I know this is going, I want to be careful that I'm not speaking about all boys here, but, you know, there are many boys who do not involve themselves in the practice of toxic masculinity. You know, back in the day there again, this was difficult for many of my friends who were mothers with good, strong feminist politics. And they wanted to educate their sons in a way where they did not demonstrate toxic masculinity. Well, then their sons were up for harassment, bullying, and so on, because they were not seen to be upholding that culture. So then they were always labeled as sissies, like girls, as fags. It just goes on and on. So, you know, part of the issue is that you don't actually have to practice. This is an important piece, is that you don't actually have to practice toxic masculinity, but you have to be seen to be supporting and upholding it as a boy.
So as to not be targeted by the rest?
Yeah, so, I mean, for self-protection, that would be one thing, but that would be a reason that a boy might choose for to exhibit toxic masculinity. But if you want to hold the present and ongoing gender politics and relations of power in place, then you better be seen to be supporting the territory of the culture of masculinity. Yeah, so it's not only about one's own individual protection, it's much more like supporting the team.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's interesting is, like, I've heard the expression notches in like an about, right? But now what you hear more is body count, which I think is even more disturbing.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But yeah, that's just a side note.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm not necessarily familiar with all the present day discourse. But yeah, so it's body count now.
Yeah, it's definitely those are still around. And I also see it in women as well. Mm-hmm. I just saw a post recently where a girl's like, my boyfriend can't be friends with other girls. And that's clearly supporting rape culture in a way. I mean, they might have trust issues, but it's kind of disturbing in a way that men and females can't be respected as friends. Mm-hmm. And that other girls would be threatened to females.
Join us every other Wednesday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. for Sam Squanch's Hideaway with your host, Anita B., as she plays all Canadian music with a focus on indie rock and pop.
Red Cat Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of two or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcat.ca for more information.
And we were, and moving on back to men and their conversations about it. We were wondering why do you think that men don't have conversations about toxic masculinity, which I guess you have answered. We also wondered, why do we see women leading these conversations? So I've seen that online quite a bit.
Great question. I think that men have many conversations that involve supporting toxic masculinity, but they themselves would never call it that. Or they themselves would never discuss toxic masculinity, but they would discuss, lots of things that represent toxic masculinity, whether it's about the kind of body count. So if that's part of a conversation, that is discussing the practice of toxic masculinity without ever naming it. Now, why I think it's not necessarily discussed by some men, first of all, they've not had the discourse available to them to talk about it. I mean, it's not part of an education for many young men. It's interesting. So you teach a course in gender, and historically, most of the people who are in that course are women. It's everything from, if you were a young man taking that course, you're suspect. Why would you be taking that course? I mean, when I taught an undergraduate course in gender and sexuality in a sociology department, the young men who took the course, I remember them saying things like, oh, I'd never be caught reading the books in the student union building. Or if I was reading the book, I'd put it inside another book and read it so no one would see the cover of the book. So, you know, what is that about? It's about, number one, why would you want to do an analysis of gender as a young man? Number two, it's suspect, like you've moved to the other side and you're not supporting the culture of masculinity. Or three, you obviously must be gay or struggling with your own sexuality. And it just goes on, so that many young men avoid those spaces. I think it's changed a bit and the needle has moved a bit. So we would find more young men taking courses in gender and sexuality and so on. But, you know, there's still a pretty strong divide.
Yeah. That to me is really interesting. So I'm a GRSJ major and I'm in my third year, and that's definitely something I've noticed. All of my friends in the program are women or non-binary, and I've noticed a lot of times I have met a few men who are majors in the program, but there have been a few times where there's been an athlete who's come into the class, and there is we do have a lot of tension between us, because it is a suspect. It's did you come in here to do you plan to argue? And I think that's it's kind of we both need to open these spaces and kind of create spaces where they can come in and learn, because a lot of times it's ignorance. You've gone through your whole life not knowing anything, and then you go to this class and your eyes are just opened, and it's a lot. It's a lot to take in.
Yeah, I think you're quite right. I mean, so it begs the question about, where are those spaces, whether it's in spaces within parenting and families, where are those spaces in universities, where are those spaces in the school system, so that young men feel somewhat comfortable accessing those spaces too. I think you're right. A lot of this is about education. I mean, that's why I fall on the side of practice. I don't think that boys and men are born bad, you know? I think we're well past that. This is not about bad people and bad attitudes and they're born bad. I mean, it's about learned behavior and then why that behavior stays in place, I will suggest there again, it's about upholding a certain kind of masculine culture. And if you don't, what does that mean for you? All the way from as adult men, perhaps being excluded from jobs, being excluded from social environments. You still hear, you know, horror stories about these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we do want to touch a bit like on the current with COVID-19 and the pandemic and a lot of what we're seeing around discourse around conspiracy theories regarding COVID-19 as well as masks. So we just want to ask, kind of discussing if you could discuss a bit the role that toxic masculinity and these kind of socializations about or of men and how that kind of relates. We've seen a lot of stories of how, like, I think one of them, the title was, I can't remember it right off the top of my head, but there's a lot of articles discussing that, like, this is the reason why men won't wear masks. The one I think was comparing it, it's the new condom. So we see a lot of this discourse about, like, why. So I'm just wondering if you can discuss that connection a little bit.
So this is not coming from the world of research, it's coming from the world of opinion now.
Yeah,
but that's okay. Let's think of the ordinary everyday discourse of some men. No one's going to tell me what to do. So I would say that has everything from mask wearing to other kinds of restrictions on our behavior during COVID. No one's going to tell me what to do is often a line that you hear from some boys and some men. You'll hear it from little boys when parents, you also hear it with girls, but you know, there's a very, there's a learning curve, I think, where the learning is that you soon learn resistance to authority. And so the mask wearing may be part of that, or refusing to abide by other restrictions may be part of that. I mean, what do the signs say? You know, freedom, not mass. It sort of speaks straight on to this. I also think the issue of, you know, I have a very good friend who works in the area of violence against women. And what we know is that household violence from men to women has gone up during the pandemic. And so there again, it's got everything from that people are shut in an environment. You know, I doubt if many people have become abusers during the pandemic. Now, that might be the case, but my suspicion is that it has escalated, but that no doubt it was there. So I think circumstances also add fuel to this during the pandemic. One is to resist authority, and the other is then all of the kinds of reasons that happens when people are in enclosed spaces without availability of other social contacts and so on. That doesn't excuse any of it. It says it's very contextual, as most behavior is, right? That's something worth pointing out too, that men don't have just a set of behaviors, nor do women, but in this case, boys and men don't have a set of behaviors which is consistent across all context. So at one point in my career, I was a school teacher, and we used to have these evenings called parents' nights. Hopefully they've changed the language around that, because we know that many students in schools do not live with parents. So, you know, Hopefully there's been a change there. But anyway, in this case, a guardian or a parent would come to see me, and they would be talking about their son or daughter. And I would think, are they talking about the same person whom I teach? And of course, it really started me thinking about, and you know, it's not rocket science, but that we all know that behavior, what I would call sets of social practice, and very much the case in masculinity, is very different depending upon the context in which a boy finds himself. So at home, he might be a loving, caring son. In a different place, he's a bully. And so I think we need to be well aware that context counts. So, you know, I've never formulated this in my own work as through kind of personality or personality theory. That's why I was hooked on the sociology of masculinity and practice rather than notions of personality.
Right.
So kind of knowing this, how would you suggest that men could start to like confront their own toxic masculinity or even start to just see it as toxic?
Well, I think that's happening, certainly happening on university campuses where men have organized groups, where there is available spaces, which we were talking about, not many have existed historically, where men can get together and discuss and let down their guard, let down their fear, and be much more open about talking about toxic masculinity more generally, and perhaps their own more specifically. I mean, you know, they've gotten a lot of cred for involving themselves in the practice of toxic masculinity because it's so widely supported in so many areas that there again, talking about it openly is always involved, not always, many times involves a lot of fear. Yeah. It makes a young man quite vulnerable, even to be seen to be going to a group like that.
Right.
So young men often develop strategies in order to accomplish entering spaces where they can feel safe to have these kinds of discussions.
Right.
So I do think it's happening on university campuses. In some schools, it's happening more. Certainly with some parents and guardians, it's happening much more. So, you know, I do think, as I said, the needle has moved and there's lots of discussion. I think we need to give lots of credibility historically to the women's movement and to feminism for raising these discussions, for doing the research, for publishing in the area, for making it much, much more widely available for discussion.
Yeah, I think that is a great point to end on, that like, yeah, things, it is, and I think also in light with social media, there's a lot of accountability. I mean, for some there's not, but I see more and more, you are able to hold people accountable and say, no, like these things, these behaviors that aren't okay. And also allowing that vulnerability to learn. So like mm-hmm. taking GRSJ classes and being able to come and raise your hand and ask questions.
Yeah, most definitely. Thank goodness the Institute is there. Right? Yes, with the courses that it offers. Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you for listening to Intersections, presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. Tune in again in 4 weeks to catch our next episode. We can always be reached at our email, genderempowerment@citr.ca, for comments, feedback, and topic ideas. Music by Hero.